Second hour of 3D on this Wednesday morning. Darren, Derek, and Donick with you. Richard Deitch from Sports Illustrated, the author of The Media Circus, coming up. Tim Hasselback to kick off the third hour of 3D, our weekly segments with him. And then Lee Jenkins. Get into a little NBA stuff with Lee Jenkins. NBA draft tomorrow night. We'll have Lee join us in the fourth and final hour of the program. We say hello to Richard Deitch. Richard, how you doing?
What's up, guys?
How you doing? What's new and exciting?
That's quite a introduction. Nothing really feels that new and exciting for me today, to be very blunt. It just feels like another one. So.
Oh, man. I thought you were
excited to be with you guys, though. I mean, when you have young kids and you don't sleep, like, to be very honest with you, just getting out of the house at a certain time feels like an accomplishment. So. Pretty much how I feel today.
Oh, okay. I asked for that. That was good. Let me start with this bizarre story. And I just want to get your take on it, and we'll probably discuss this a little bit more at length later in the show. So you've got this guy who has season tickets to the Bears and the Packers. And I guess through, you know, however, being a season ticket holder for the Bears, he somehow was able to get a pass where a pregame deal where he's going to get to go down on the field before the Bears-Packers game. He shows up to that wearing all Packers stuff. He's got beads and a jersey and everything. And remember, he's doing this as a Bears season ticket holder. That's how he got the access to go down for the pregame. Well, the Bears people tell him, sorry, you're not going down on the field dressed like that. He is suing the Bears, not for financial gain, but suing them to, I guess, reverse their policy and allow anybody to take part in an on-field experience at Soldier Field. Well, what's your take without me weighing in on this? What's your take just hearing that? Just your first thoughts?
Well, I mean, I think teams, as a general rule, kind of get ridiculous in terms of, you know, what fans can wear, what they can't wear, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All that said, and again, you'd have to find a lawyer who would know better, and Nashville certainly has its share of lawyers. But my sense is that because they're a private organization or a private club, they have the right to dictate what someone can or cannot be doing on their field. So it feels like legally they have the right to do that. And, you know, the other thing, too, is it's not necessarily, I shouldn't phrase it as a negative. It is good PR for them to sort of make this statement because you're letting the larger fan base know that, you know, you're standing by those who root for this particular team. And, you know, you're not going to show any on-field love for the other team. But, you know, it's a larger, interesting question that gets into sort of just beyond this seemingly silly story. It's kind of like, what are fans allowed to do in an arena when it comes to bringing signs in, when it comes to wearing stuff? Like, how far can and should ownership go in censoring that? Like, for example, and I'm honestly not saying this is right or wrong, but like, if I go to an arena and I wear a shirt that has a curse word in a foreign language on that shirt, should some security guy come over and tell me to leave his arena or not? If I have a sign, like, that I come to the Redskins field, which says Dan Snyder's a horrible owner, I don't curse or anything, I just say, you know, like, is someone going to pull that sign down? The answer is probably yes, and then if so, do they have, like, a legal right to do that? That's always interesting to me, is sort of, you know, how far can ownership sort of go in some of this kind of stuff? And then maybe, and this is where I guess if you read the back of your ticket, maybe ownership has the right to do anything they want once you step into their facility.
I kind of feel like you live in a bad neighborhood. There's always sirens going on during our weekly chat with you. Is that a wrong assumption? Is that a bad assumption?
Yeah, you got to keep in New mind, York. I live in, like, what, a 6-mile square area with 10 million people. There's a lot going on. So inevitably you're going to get buses and sirens and stuff. But, yeah, I seem to have a bad habit with you guys. There's always like, a siren going on in the background. The other thing, too, is I don't know if Nashville's like this, but once the weather turns really hot in New York, Like, it's a whole second level of crazy. and so there's always something going on in the, you know, that's, I don't know who sang the song. It was the Rascal Flatts. Well, that famous song about, like, sort of hot times, summer in the city, back of my neck feeling dirty and gritty. Like, that is, like, the quintessential New York song where just, like, kind of craziness goes on when you have 10 million people baking in a very small place.
You know, to your point, going back to the original discussion, that was going on here. I'm sure you've read the articles that were put out there that NBC reps were walking around and offering fans who had signs, derogatory signs about Mike Milbury during the Stanley Cup final, offering them, let's say, gifts to take
a hat or a shirt,
you know,
or something like that.
Silly, yeah, an NBC hat or shirt really wasn't a very good gift, to take their sign away. And, of course, they were declined on every offer. People were like, go, you know, beat it. This is, I have the right to do this. It brings up a question of, you know, how, what is acceptable and what's not acceptable. I don't know if that falls under the same umbrella what I brought up, but it kind of feels the same.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just saying, the interesting thing, too, in that discussion is that culturally, what might be acceptable in Nashville might not be acceptable in Louisville, might not be acceptable in Des Moines, which may be acceptable in New York or Los Angeles. So a lot of that, too, I think probably has to do with what part of the country you're in. NBC, though, they're just asking for that story to get out there and to be sort of, you know, shamed in that. You put on a provocative broadcaster. You are essentially paying him, in my opinion, to be provocative. I'm not a Mike Milbury fan at all. I think kind of like his stuff is just like from, like, bad Don Cherry to me. And so if people react to that, as they should, the idea that you're going to go through this, you pay some helpless intern to go through the stands, you know, offering an NBC Sports hat so that people aren't chanting F Mike Milbury is just silly. If you put a provocateur on the air, you have to understand that there are going to be fans who react to said provocateur, and if they are in, you know, the arena with this person, they're going to chant that. Obviously, nobody wants anybody to approach Mike Milbury and do anything physically, but I think every fan has a right to chant and say whatever they want, particularly if you're paying this guy to give provocative opinions.
We're talking with Richard Deitch, SI.com. Now, Richard, we've talked several times about the NBA, and I keep bringing it up to you because it's fascinating to me. And what I want to ask you is it good in a sense that, and you might see it different, that one guy has the NBA held hostage in regards to trades being offered, where guys want to go? It seems as if everyone essentially is waiting on what LeBron James is going to do and then sort of make moves, or they're making moves before he chooses to either stay in Cleveland or go elsewhere to try to either A, eventually end up with him, or B, to beat him. And I know I've asked this question before, and you say, hey, super teams are great because it makes it entertaining. You know, you get to watch your favorite players all on one channel at one time. But one guy having so much, to me, pull on what's going on from a maneuvering standpoint with other players is crazy.
By the way, this was Derek's audition tape for FS1. So congratulations.
That was my next question.
Man, taking a shot at my man, LeBron James.
No, I love LeBron. No, I am a huge LeBron fan.
I understand where you're coming from. Yeah, here's my answer to you. One, Derek, I would say someone did beat him. Mm-hmm. So the premise might be flawed to start with, because the Cavs didn't win this year. The Golden State Warriors won. Now, you make the argument maybe everybody's trying to chase the Warriors and figure it out. But I cannot hold LeBron James or be critical of this, because his talent has dictated what this system is. You just happen to have a guy, and maybe Durant is coming close to catching him, or I'm sure some believe past him. But you have such an outlier in talent where a singular guy in a league can essentially guarantee you, if you have him and you put sort of the right parts around him, you're either getting to the conference finals or the finals, just based on how great he is against the rest of the league. So, I mean, I know where you're coming from, but I just think this is a outlier situation in that he is so gifted and so great and makes people around him so much better that he's the one outlier where if he went to Memphis next year or the Brooklyn Nets or stayed with the Cavs, they're going to be a favorite in whatever, maybe not in the West, but if, you know, he goes to any Eastern Conference team, they would be a favorite. In terms of sort of teams trying to figure it out, man, that's, to me, that's part of the deal. That's why you pay these general managers and analytics people and draft people all this money, is to try to figure out, you know, how can we make the attempt to beat this guy? I just think, Derek, the reality is, until LeBron gets old, and given his body and given how he just sort of like seems to just be a different cat in terms of his ability to withstand injury, I don't think this is going to happen for two or three more years in the East. The larger question to me is, if the Warriors can somehow keep their base intact, who can beat them in the next 4 years? You know, let's even say Iguodala, who's a great, great player, and let's say he's the one guy they can't keep based on money. If they keep those other four guys, I think I've talked about this on your show, there's always going to be great players nearing the end of their career who want to chase a ring, who will play for the Warriors at a discount. So that, to me, would be the more interesting question is, I feel like the league is really, if you want to consider them, quote-unquote, being held hostage, I feel like they're being held hostage by the greatness of the Warriors, and that other than maybe the Spurs, maybe the Cavs, and I'm not even sure I buy that anymore, I don't think there's any other team that can beat them in the next 3 or 4 years if they keep these guys intact.
Yeah, it's just it's crazy because I've never, and I've watched basketball for a long time, and I know the rules were different when Jordan and those guys were playing. The guys were not moving as much. But you just see one guy in the last 10 years. It's just either you want to play with them, which is good, or you're trying to find a way to beat them, which the Golden State Warriors have twice.
Right. Well, here's, I mean, you know, the thing I would say is, like, you know, I mean, it's, you can look deep into the system in the 80s, and yeah, you didn't have, the system was different.
Exactly.
But I would say that part of the reason some of these teams were great was that there were just morons running other franchises. Like, the person who made that Mikhail Parrish trade,
oh, yeah,
was the worst trade in NBA history. So if you give those Celtics two Hall of Famers, they're going to be great forever. I mean, again, it's a little before my time, but why did the Bucks give up Kareem? That doesn't make any sense. To me, he's arguably the greatest player of all time. How could you allow him to get to a Los Angeles team? And then, you know, you look at the Celtics with Bird and the Lakers with Magic. You know, why didn't teams try to figure out a way around that so that those teams didn't end up getting those players? So, like, I know what you're saying, but I feel like at least in the old days, where maybe the system wasn't being held hostage by a singular player, the system was ridiculous because there were a lot of teams that just made, I mean, terrible, terrible deals, not, you know, including that Golden State deal, which, you know, if you're the Celtics, it's probably the greatest deal in basketball history. I'm not sure we'll ever see a trade where you got two Hall of Fame, two top 50 players in a singular trade. I mean, maybe that'll happen again, but that would strike me as that would strike me. And then lastly, and this is where, and again, I'm a huge Jordan fan. He was the greatest player sort of my, you know, teenage year growing up, and he will always be number one for me. But it's not like he stayed with the Bulls his whole career. I mean, people seem to forget he did go to, you know, he did go to Washington for a couple of years, and yeah, they didn't win the championship, but the whole mythology of, you know, Michael would never do this, or Michael would never do that, or Michael never lost in the playoffs, it's like, that stuff's also not true. It took Jordan some time to become Jordan.
It did. Richard Deitch is with us, SI.com, the Media Circus. Richard, I feel like I have a better appreciation for this because with Fox Sports Tennessee, you don't have the rights to do the broadcast after the first round. So we were left to do just post-game coverage. So the locker room, the last couple of rounds of the playoffs, that was me. I was doing what Doris Burke and some of the people you chronicled in one of your latest articles did. And I used to think about sideline reporters and post-game reporters, hey, it's an easy job. You just get the guy, you ask a couple of questions, and you're done. You know, but really the best do put a lot of thought into it, and the questions can make a difference, even though pretty much anybody could ask some easy questions. But I really did find myself trying to scrutinize, how do you make this the best 2 minutes that you're going to have, or not even that, with these particular players?
Yeah, here's what I would say. It's an interesting point you say, Willie, is that the job itself, like, fundamentally is not hard. It's not hard if you sort of have television presence to ask a question after a game, you know, particularly if you don't sort of get nervous on camera. Where it's excruciatingly hard is, can you provide something interesting for the audience behind the banalities and cliches that a lot of questions you know, sort of provide us? Or are you just an over-the-top homer and you're not really interested in any kind of journalism? You're just sort of just part of the team apparatus. And that's where I think Doris Burke is really, really gifted in that. And you may think her questions are too long-winded, but if you listen to her questions, they're open-ended and they're smart, meaning that the person who's answering the questions has to provide you with interesting answers. Like in journalism school, they teach you, like, ask questions that start with how or why. Why do you do that? Because the subject has to answer the question. They have to give you a response, as opposed to if you answered a question like, you know, do you like blank? Well, that sets up the subject to just say either yes or no. And so a lot of times that's Doris Burke and the best people who do this, that's sort of their gift, is that they're able to ask open-ended, really smart questions that elicit interesting answers from their subjects. And in Doris Burke's case, in the trophy presentation, as you know, Willie, that is just a tough assignment. You are on a stage. The whole arena can hear you. There's 30 million people at home watching you. There's chaos all around you. There's people celebrating. And you got to ask seven different people, you know, maybe 13, 14 questions. So you got to come up with different stuff for each of those individuals. And I thought that after the Game 5 of the NBA Finals, she just hit it out of the park, including getting some really interesting stuff from Draymond Green, which, again, that ceremony is not – we have seen it before, whether it's, you know, Aaron Andrews, no offense to her, or some others who, quite frankly – really just do not provide you much or did not provide you much in terms of getting stuff from players. And that's where you see whether it's Tafoya or Doris Burke. I feel like Rinaldi's good at this. Obviously, Ernie Johnson is solid at this. Listen to what the subject says off the questions, and you as a viewer often learn something. And that, to me, is the deciding factor. Like, if I learn something from an athlete or coach or owner from a trophy presentation, that means the questioner did a great job.
That's a great point. And when you do three interviews, you have to find different questions for the three people, which is not easy. You can find yourself asking the same three questions to the same three people,
right?
And you get the same three answers, but you want to cover more ground than that. That's a great
right.
point.
Talk about how you feel about winning a championship. Well,
yeah.
Gee, I feel fantastic. What an incredible – I mean, you know, instead of like, you know, why – you know, why were you guys able to hold off Team X in the last 2 minutes? Like, that, you know, there's a big difference. You'll get something from the latter question. The first question is just, you know, I love these guys. It's great. I'm happy to be here. The Azaleas are beautiful. It's the Masters, blah, 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 blah.
All right. Derek's dying to ask about the future of Ray Lewis.
Hold on. Let's the FDNY go past.
Okay.
All right. Go ahead.
No, you alluded to it. You said I was doing my audition for FS1. FS1 has announced that.
Well,
you're
halfway there, Derek, based exactly. on that LeBron drafting.
FSU has they've announced that Ray Lewis will be added to their long list
their roster.
Of rosters, people
right.
on their rosters. Does that bring anything to FS1?
Yeah, I mean, it gives them a great linebacker.
Yeah,
and a
besides a great,
I mean,
yeah.
no, I mean, this is not to knock Ray Lewis, but, mm-hmm. you know, he's a fine, generic analyst who's super famous. And as you know, Derek, you played in the NFL. If you are super famous, there is value for a television network in that everyone will recognize who Ray Lewis is, one of mm-hmm. the great defensive players of all time. So it's a good person to put on a press release, and it's a good name that you can promote. But as we saw at ESPN, you know, Ray had a lot of reps at ESPN. And as a general rule, he didn't really how do I sort of phrase it?
He didn't get better.
He wasn't a difference maker. It's not like I don't think he sort of worked at it, or it's not like I think he was mailing it in. I just don't particularly think he said so many interesting things to reviewers, which was ironic because you would have tagged him prior to his hire as this firebrand, like inspirational type of talker who could be a really interesting television presence. This is independent of whether you think Ray Lewis did or did not commit a crime in Atlanta. Let's just like sort of forget about that for a second if we can. I'm talking about as a broadcaster, you would have thought that this guy would have been really, really interesting just given in his NFL film stuff, you know, the guy's like, he really is like a motivational, inspirational speaker. But whatever it is, it didn't necessarily translate to ESPN. He now goes to Fox where he's going to be asked to be more of an opinionist, and we'll see. Maybe that's a better fit for Ray Lewis than a traditional broadcaster. But Derek, if you had to ask me, like, does he make a difference? No, I don't think so. But, you know, if you're Ray, you're in Los Angeles, you're cashing a nice check from Fox, and it's not very hard, in all honesty, to, like, you know, debate the topic of the day with Colin Cowherd or whoever else floats through these shows. So, you know, if you're Ray, you take the money. But honestly, no, I don't see him as a guy who, in my opinion, is like viewing, must viewing. Like, he's not, Ray Lewis is, this is, again, I'm just going to speak for me, Ray Lewis will never be a person who makes me want to change the channel to hear what he has to say. And that is surprising, because I might have bet 3 years ago he would have been that person.
I'll remember next week not to ask you what's new and exciting, because I think you kind of broke out into your Louis C.K. bet just a little bit.
I gave you a little bit of sort of New York angst today. I was trying to ratchet it up.
Appreciate it as always. Have a great rest of your week. We'll do it again next week.
You got it. See you guys.
Yep.
Richard Deitch, Sports Illustrated, author of The Media Circus. We'll be back.